Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Okay, so let us start this afternoon session on the suttas that I have brought. Have you all got the suttas for yourself? Yeah? Okay. I'm not sure if they're all in there, but it doesn't really matter. If they're not there, I added a few at the last minute. It doesn't really. I think the suttas still okay. Yeah. So, just to explain a little bit about the idea behind this before we start. The idea is basically to have a practical sutta study, one which goes with meditation practice, that you actually, the reading of the suttas enhances the meditation, and the meditation in turn enhances the understanding of the suttas. And this is one, I think, one of the best ways of reading the suttas is always to keep the practicalities in mind. Oh, that's very loud. Okay. So keep the practicalities in mind to make sure that we read them in a way which is not intellectual or purely intellectual, but has a practical side to it. I think that's an important aspect. So when you start to read the suttas, one of the interesting things for me, and this is the thing that you hear a lot about, is what is actually the most important suttas that the Buddha taught? Is it possible to say, is it possible to kind of narrow it down to these suttas are more important, these are less important? And if you know which ones are the most important ones, of course then you can focus on the important ones, right? So what actually are the important suttas, or the most important suttas? And very often you will hear that the most important sutta in the Pali Canon is the Satipatthana Sutta. This is what people often will say. And if you read books about Buddhism, there's countless times does it say in there, you know, Satipatthana Sutta, the most important sutta in Buddhism, etc., etc. But if you actually look at the suttas themselves, and if you ask yourself, what is the basis for saying these things? Is there really any basis for saying that the Satipatthana Sutta is the most important? What is that basis? And the only really relevant basis for saying such a thing would be if the Buddha himself said that. If the Buddha said, this is the most important sutta, practice this, that's all you really have to do, then you have a good reason for accepting that claim. But really, there is nothing in the suttas themselves, in the Satipatthana Sutta, which say that this is the most important one. I'm not saying it is less important, I'm just saying it is one sutta among many. And it doesn't really have any special claim to being the most important one. So if the Satipatthana Sutta, or if you like, the Mahasatipatthana Sutta, is not the most important, then which one is it? And I would say that to decide what is the most important sutta is you have to look at the Pali Canon overall and look at the teachings the Buddha gave the most often. What are the teachings which recur again and again in the Pali Canon? And among the long discourses in the Digha Nikaya and the Majjhima Nikaya, there's one teaching in particular which occurs again and again, I think about 30 times perhaps. And that teaching is usually called in English the gradual training. And this is the one you find again and again. And I would say, if you are going to choose one sutta which might be more important than anything else, perhaps that is a wrong idea to even do that, but if you are going to do that, I would say the gradual training, in my opinion, again this is just my opinion, is probably the most important one, because that is what was taught so often. So for that reason, I have chosen a sutta on the gradual training as the backbone of this sutta readings and of this sutta teachings. And the particular sutta I have chosen is called the Chula Hattipadopama Sutta, which means the shortest sutta on the simile of the elephant's footprint. And for those of you, I'm not going to start with that sutta, but for those of you who know a little bit, I'm sure probably most of you will know this already, the first sutta that was taught in Sri Lanka when the Arahant Mahindra came to Sri Lanka was precisely this sutta. So you can see its importance right away, right? This is the first sutta that was taught when the Arahant Mahindra came to Sri Lanka. So I thought it would be nice to teach it anyway because of the history of the sutta. So both because of its importance and also because of its history. And what this sutta does, for those of you who don't know the sutta that well, what it does, it outlines the training of a person from the moment that they become a Buddhist all the way to the end of the path to become an arahant, a fully awakened person. It outlines the whole training, and it gives the training in a basically quite a detailed form in the gradual training here. So that is going to be the basis for these sutta talks. And then as I go along, I will bring in other suttas from other places, and I will use that to fill in, to sort of add and expand on that gradual training here. So that is the theory behind this. Now, before I start with this gradual training, I want to look at a couple of suttas which give a little bit of background information, a little bit of different views on how to look at these suttas. The first one of these suttas that give this sort of background information is the first one, I think, hopefully the first one you have as well. It's called the Soil Remover Sutta. And this Soil Remover Sutta is in a sense similar to the gradual training, but it compresses the gradual training and it talks about it in a different way here. And because of that, I thought it might be interesting to have a look at this sutta first of all, to get a perspective on the Buddhist path, but how it actually functions. This Soil Remover Sutta is basically about the simile of the smith, how a smith purifies gold. And it compares the purification of gold to the purification of mind that happens in not just meditation, but throughout the practice of the Eightfold Path. This is the purpose of this particular sutta. Okay, so I will just start off reading a little bit, and then I will explain what is actually happening here as we go along here. So this is from the Soil Remover Sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya 3, number 101, and this particular text I have here is from the translation into English by Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi here. And it goes as follows. Bhikkhus, there are gross defilements of gold, soil, grit, and gravel. Now the soil remover or his apprentice first pours the gold into a trough and washes, rinses, and cleans it. When that has been removed and eliminated, there still remain middle-sized defilement in the gold, fine grit and coarse sand. The soil remover or his apprentice washes, rinses and cleans it again. When that has been removed and eliminated, there still remain subtle defilements in the gold, fine sand and black dust. So the soil remover and his apprentice washes, rinses and cleans it again. When that has been removed and eliminated, only grains of gold remain. The goldsmith or his apprentice now pours the gold into a melting pot and fans it, melts it and smelts it. But even when this has been done, the gold is not yet settled and the dross has not yet been entirely removed. The gold is not yet malleable, wieldy, luminous, but still brittle and not fit for work. But as the goldsmith and his apprentice continues to fan, melt and smelt the gold, a time comes when the gold is settled and the dross has been entirely removed, so that the gold becomes malleable, wieldy and luminous, pliant and properly fit for work. Then whatever kind of ornament the goldsmith wishes to make from it, whether a bracelet, earrings, a necklace, a golden garland, he can achieve his purpose. So there you are. So that is the simile of the goldsmith, how the goldsmith purifies the gold to make it ready, to make it malleable and useful for whatever purpose he wants to use it for. And then the second section, which I'm not going to read quite yet, then shows you how the training of the mind is basically very similar to the purification of gold. You have to purify the mind stage by stage. Then eventually there comes a time when you can basically use the mind in exactly the way you want, in the same way that you can use the gold in the way that you want to use it. So one of the, I think, important points of this simile, and I will bring some of these points out now before I actually go on to the rest of the sutta. And one of the important points that you will notice is that there is a certain sequence to the cleaning of gold, right? You start with the coarse things, then you do the middling things, then you do the refined things. And then eventually, when you have removed the refined things, then when you smelt that gold, only then is it possible to use that gold in the right way. And this idea of sequence is actually quite important to understand, because this is very relevant for also for the training of the mind. If you're going to train the mind, there is a sequence to removal of the defilements. You cannot start sitting down and trying to meditate and, you know, watch the breath if you have a very coarse mind state. It's never going to work. You have to start off with the basic things. You have to start off with the Panchasila, the five precepts, and then you have to gradually purify the mind by thinking in the right way, intending in the right way, and then you have to purify the mind more. And eventually, if you do the sequence in the right way, only then will you have success in your meditation practice. And this is very important, because if you don't understand that, if you don't look at yourself, understand your mind, understand where you are at on the path, what are my problems, what do I have to do, what do I have to deal with, if you start in the wrong place, you're going to get frustrated, and eventually you're going to give up, and you're going to say, this Buddhist meditation is useless, you know, it can't be done, it's a waste of time. But actually, the reason you can't do it is not because the path doesn't work, it's because you haven't applied the path in the right way. So the important point here is to understand yourself, know yourself well enough to know what your defilements are. So for example, if you are a person who has difficulties keeping the five precepts in ordinary life, then that should be your first priority. There's no point in coming to a meditation retreat if even you find that difficult, because if you do, the purification process hasn't gone deep enough yet. So that should really be the first priority. Then, when that is done, then you can start to move in the direction of purifying the further defilements. So please keep that in mind. Know yourself, know where you're at, understand your mind, understand what you need to do, and then apply the right measure for whatever point on the path you are at. Okay, so that is the sequence. Then that is the importance of there actually being a sequence, which starts with the grosser things and gradually moves down to the more refined things, stage by stage. Now, some of the terms that are used here, I don't know if I should probably have a look at some of these terms here, because they're quite interesting, some of these terms that are used here. So once the gold has been refined down, once the gold has reached a stage where all the impurities have been taken out, maybe one of the things I should actually mention before that, before I go on to these terms, is you see here how the sequence actually says that the gold is not malleable. Then it says, but there comes a time when it becomes malleable, right? So this is an interesting point. Why does it say there comes a time? It doesn't say when all the defilements are removed. It doesn't say when you have done this or done that. It just says there comes a time. And the point with that is, I think, is simply that sometimes you don't know when the results are going to come in the meditation practice. Sometimes you don't know when the results are going to come in purifying gold in exactly the same way. Sometimes you just keep applying yourself. And gradually, as you apply yourself, the results start to come little by little. And eventually, there comes a time when this happens. You don't know when it's going to be here. You don't know when it's going to happen. It happens by itself in its own time. And that is the purpose here. And this has very important consequences. Remember, the consequences of this is that is not to actually desire these goals, desire samadhi, desire jhana space, desire to become a sotapanna, sovan, I think you call it here in Sri Lanka, not to desire these things because you don't know when they're going to happen. If you start to desire them, I want this, I want that, and you don't know when it's going to happen, you might just get frustrated and upset. What you should do instead of desiring the result is to apply the effort into the causes that gives rise to the results. That is the right way of doing it. And if you keep doing that, if you keep looking at the causes, then you know that the results will eventually come all by themselves in their own time. And you know there is that, there is another well-known sutta in the Samyutta Nikaya, which is called, I can't remember what it's called now, unfortunately, but it, basically it is another simile here. And it talks about the simile of a ship that has been lying on the kind of the beach for a long period of time. And gradually, as it is sitting on the beach there, over the months, over the years, the ropes and the rigging on the ship, they start to rot, and eventually the ship collapses completely. I hope I got that right, because I'm a bit vague about this particular sutta. But anyway, it doesn't matter so much. And then the Buddha says, this is comparable to somebody who wants to attain enlightenment. Gradually, gradually, the defilements are decreased, the mind matures, the qualities of mind get stronger, that reach that eventually will mature in enlightenment. And when the time is ripe, then it happens by itself. Or there's a simile of the adze or axe. The adze is some kind of instrument to use to polish wood with, I think. And an adze, after it, or an axe handle, after it has been used for many, many years, if you look at the handle, and you can see finger marks on that handle. And then the Buddha says, well, do you know? You know, yesterday I wore away so much of that handle, the day before I wore away so much, and today I've been wearing away so much. And of course the answer is no, you don't know how much you've been wearing away. All you know is that now it has reached this particular state. And it's the same again with the defilements of the mind. You just apply the method, you apply the right way, and then gradually these things get removed. You don't concern yourself with the results, you concern yourself with the causes that eventually lead to the results. So that is, I think, the explanation of a very simple phrase, there comes a time. It is something you probably, when you read it first time, you just pass by without noticing it. But often these little things actually have a meaning. And then, of course, that time comes, and that time is the time when the goal is malleable, wieldy, luminous, pliant, and properly fit for work. Now, these words here are actually quite important words, because these words are also used for the mind itself further down, and certainly in other suttas. And the word here, malleable, is mudu in Pali. Mudu means soft, soft. And this tells you something about the kind of mind you want to develop. It has to be mudu, right? It has to be soft, gentle, kind, an easy mind, not a hard mind, but a gentle mind, a soft mind. So this, again, it shows you a little bit about whether you are developing in the right way. Are you becoming a more soft person? Are you becoming more gentle? Are you becoming more easygoing? Are you becoming more kind? Are you becoming more generous? You can look inside of yourself. If these things are happening, you know that you're going in the right direction. This is very important, this thing about knowing whether you're going in the right direction, because it means that you can judge yourself, you can monitor yourself. You look at yourself and you understand whether you're actually doing the right thing. You take charge of your own spiritual path. You don't let anybody else take charge of it. Then we have this idea, malleable, wieldy, kammaniya in Pali. Kammaniya is from kamma. Kamma is like work or action, right? Kammaniya means workable. In other words, it's fit for work, fit for action. You can use it, you can apply it in various ways. This is the idea here. And of course, the idea is applying the mind means applying it to those things that give rise to awakening, right? This is the purpose here. So the mind is fit, capable of getting those insights and those profound understandings which awakening is implied by awakening here. And then we have another term here which is very interesting. This is, term is luminous. This is pabbasara, and a very quite an important word in the suttas, and it is a word that you will hear about very often. Many people have written articles about things that they call the pabbasara citta. Citta is the mind, right, or the heart. Pabbasara means luminous or radiant. So it literally means the radiant heart or the luminous mind or something like that. So, and often, and so what does this actually mean? This is the problem. What is the pabbasara citta? And the way to actually understand what a term like the pabbasara citta means is to see how the word pabbasara is used in the suttas. And the way it is used is just like here: when the gold is free of defilements, then it is pabbasara. And elsewhere it says the same thing about the mind: when the mind is free of defilements, then it is pabbasara. And especially it is the mind in very deep samadhi, the fourth jhana, that is called the pabbasara mind. This is a little thing, this is a small thing, and many of you may not be able to properly appreciate the point I'm making here, because it is actually quite an important point, because sometimes you can get carried away by a term like that, pabbasara citta, and give it meanings which actually it doesn't really have in the suttas. And this is always dangerous, because then we might get on the wrong track with the word of the Buddha. All it means is the luminous mind, the beautiful mind that arises when the mind is absolutely pure. There's no defilements left. It's luminous. There's like a light inside, right? It's like the Buddha talks about enlightenment. He says it's like darkness being dispelled and light arising. This is what happens in the mind. And I'm sure you know yourself a little bit what that means. You have some idea. On some days the mind is a bit more dark. On other days a bit more bright, right? So you can see what is roughly what is meant by this. Okay, so then it is wieldy, luminous, it is not, the gold is no longer brittle, and it is properly fit for work. This again, properly fit for work, the idea of things being, you can use it for whatever purpose you want to use it for. So, one of the things that is also interesting about this these similes here, one of the most wonderful things that I find in the suttas are precisely the similes of the Buddha. You can often read the text, the actual discourse, the technical things, and often it can seem a bit dry and you don't really understand. Sometimes it may seem very profound. But then when you read a simile like this, it brings it to life, right? It's like a goldsmith purifying gold. Very easy to understand, right? Removing the dross, removing the gravel, stage by stage, very down to earth, very straight to the point. And then through these similes, you can very often understand even the most profound word of the Buddha, just through the similes. And there are so many similes like this throughout the suttas. For me, this is one of the joys of reading the suttas, just to read the similes and just see how profound they are here and how beautiful they are. There's a more similes coming later on, and I will put them in here, not necessarily because they fit into the suit as I'm going to read, but just because I like the similes. I thought I'd stick them in there because I like the similes. I'm being a bit naughty there, but I hope you forgive me for that. Okay, so that's just about a little bit about the clearness of the similes and how down to earth they actually are. Okay, so that is about the purification of gold. And then it says, of course, and this is the important point towards the end here, once the gold is purified, then it is fit to make whatever you want with it. And we will see this is exactly the same as it is with the mind. Only then can you actually work the gold properly. Okay, so let us do the second half now of the sutta. So, two bhikkhus, when a bhikkhu is devoted to the higher mind, there are in him gross defilements, bodily, verbal and mental misconduct. An earnest, capable bhikkhu abandons, dispels, terminates and obliterates them. When this has been done, there remain in him middling defilements, sensual thoughts, thoughts of ill will, thoughts of harming. An earnest, capable bhikkhu abandons, dispels, terminates and obliterates them. When this has been done, there remain in him subtle defilements, thoughts about his relations, thoughts about his country, and thoughts about his reputation. An earnest, capable bhikkhu abandons, dispels, terminates, and obliterates them. When this has been done, then there remain thoughts connected with the Dhamma. That concentration is not peaceful and sublime, not gained by full tranquilization, not attained to unification, but is reined in and checked by forcefully suppressing the defilements. Okay, I'll stop there because otherwise you get too much information in one go. There's so much information in this, in a passage like that. It's absolutely astonishing. It's just sometimes almost too much. So, here you are. This is then how you refine the mind in the same way as you refine gold. It's quite nice, this idea that the mind is like gold, isn't it? It's like something very beautiful there. This is one of the things I didn't say before, but here obviously the gold is actually what is the equivalent of mind in real life. So mind is like gold. What we're mining, what we're looking for in here, what we're trying to achieve, is something very beautiful. Something like gold. In fact, of course the reality is it's much more valuable than gold. Gold just gives you a hint of how valuable the mind is. Pure mind is much, much more valuable than anything else in the world. Simply because of the amount of happiness that it produces. So it says here, so too bhikkhus, when a bhikkhu is devoted to the higher mind. Now here, this is one thing which is difficult to understand unless you are used to reading the suttas. What is the meaning of the higher mind? This is the adhicitta in Pali. And the higher mind basically is a reference to samadhi. So it means the mind that attains samadhi, attains a deep state of stillness in meditation practice. And in particular, the kind of meditation that it refers to is the jhana states, which are defined, the higher mind is defined as the jhana states. So, what we are seeing here, this whole sutta is about how to attain samadhi, how to attain jhana. This is what it's concerned with. And to do that, you then have to go through this gradual process of purification. That is how it happens. I should say at this point perhaps, and I think this is another important point that I wanted to make of this particular sutta, and that is to attain jhana means a process of purification. Sometimes people think that attaining samadhi or attaining jhana or attaining deep stillness of the mind means getting the technique right, watching the breath in the right way, doing enough metta meditation, doing insight meditation on the body, doing mantras or whatever it is. If I get the technique right, if I just watch the breath in the right way, if I count the breath backwards, sometimes you do that because if you count it backwards, it requires more effort, right? This is the idea behind this. It requires more effort, so it's easier to keep your attention there. So people think that meditation is about a method, getting the method right. But the reality is, and this is what you see here, that method is not really so important. Because watching the breath is easy, right? It should be very easy. The breath is just there, all you have to do is watch it. It can't really be that much method to watching the breath. And in fact, when you read we're going to do that later on, the Anapanasati Sutta, there isn't really much method at all. There's just this idea of awareness. So why then doesn't it work? Why can't we do it if it is so easy? And the reason is because of the defilements. That is why you can't do it. So it is the removal of defilements that make meditation possible. And if meditation isn't coming together, the reason is because of defilements of the mind. That is the reason, not a misunderstanding of how to apply yourself. Sometimes there can be a little bit of misunderstanding how to apply the method, of course. It is possible to misunderstand it, but generally speaking, it is the defilements of the mind that actually stop you from being able to apply yourself in meditation practice. So remember that. So then you have to ask yourself, well, what are the problems I have? Just like I was saying before, you need to find out where on the path you are, know yourself, understand yourself. What problems do I have? Do I maybe get too angry sometimes? Do I have too many strong desires? So the most likely reason, either you haven't got enough a sense of kindness towards the people around you, too much negativity or anger perhaps, or there's too much desire in the mind. These are the two main areas which block one, or two main kind of defilements. Okay, so then once you have once we have established this, then of course you start to abandon the defilements, right? You start to actually do something about it. And of course in the beginning, as I said before, you start with the coarse defilements, bodily, verbal and mental misconduct. So what does it mean, bodily, verbal and mental misconduct? Well, it means the best explanation for this thing is things called the dasa akusala kammapada, which are the 10 ways of unwholesome action, and this you can see this throughout the suttas, and this is like the 5 precepts, plus it also adds in there the right ways of speaking, not speaking harsh speech, not speaking divisive speech which divide people, not idle chatter, and the mental conduct, which is not having kind of harsh thoughts about others, may these beings die and perish, you know, being basically angry, or desire the property of others and wrong view. These are the things. I'm not going to go into that in too much detail right now. We may have a chance to get back to those things later on. So this is the gross defilements. And I would say in particular, if the defilements are so strong that they cause a person to break the 5 precepts, that is probably a very clear sign that the defilements are quite gross. But basically, anything which comes under those 10 akusala, dasa akusala kamapata, can be considered relatively coarse at the very least. So then it says, the earnest and capable bhikkhu, in other words, somebody who is practicing, understands what he's doing, understands the right way, he, and then comes this interesting phrase, he abandons them, dispels them, terminates and obliterates them. Now this is a very interesting phrase. Why is it so interesting? Because when you read that phrase, it sounds like you're going to have to use enormous amounts of willpower and go in there like a warrior, cutting down the defilements, removing them forever, using a lot of power in your mind. But is that what it really means? I think anybody who has a little bit of experience in meditation practice knows that if you use a lot of willpower, it often tends to obstruct the meditation. Meditation is about peace. It's about sitting back. It's about allowing things to calm down, not to use enormous amounts of willpower. And this sounds almost like, you know, you grit your teeth and you do, you know, whatever you can basically to kind of, you know, destroy the defilement, so to speak. So for this reason, because it sounds like one thing, but perhaps it doesn't quite mean that, for that reason, this phrase is quite important. And this is also one of those areas where if you read the suttas on your own, you may misunderstand the actual meaning of what's happening here. And this is why I want to emphasize a little bit here what I think this actually means. And what it means, again, you have to read other suttas to actually understand that. What it means, to my mind, is that you use wisdom to abandon these things. You think to yourself, this is unwholesome. You understand that this is going to lead to suffering for yourself and other people. You understand that it's caught up with pain and problems. And because of that level of understanding, insight, wisdom, whatever, it is through that that you actually abandon these things. And that is why it uses these very strong words, terminates, obliterates, and dispels. And the reason for that is because when you use wisdom, when you actually look at something in the right way, the problem disappears like that. Willpower can never do that. You can never get anything to disappear like that using willpower. With willpower, you can maybe suppress it a bit or push it aside a little bit. And as soon as you relax, it comes back in again, right? But wisdom is the only thing which has the ability to really obliterate something and to do away with it, because you understand its suffering. And this is a very important point. This is how insight works. Insight works, you understand that something is suffering. It's like you pick up a hot piece of something, like a piece of coal or something, by accident, to pick it up. You don't keep on holding it. As soon as you realize you've done a mistake, you let go, right? Because it's painful. It's suffering. in exactly the same way. This is what insight is. Insight is having some appreciation that this is painful. And when you understand, when you remember that this is painful, you may make a mistake, you may go the wrong way because of lack of mindfulness. Then as soon as the mindfulness comes back, and you remember that this is painful, this is dangerous, this is dukkha, then you let go. Just like letting go of a hot cola. And of course, what that means, it means that sometimes you have to reflect on things, you have to think. And this, for me, is a large part of what Vipassana practice is about, is to reflect about the world in the right way, to actually understand that those things that are suffering really are suffering. For example, if you want to reduce your kind of your anger or your negative mind states, how do you do that? Well, understand that anger actually is dangerous. It goes in the wrong way. It leads to suffering. That is a very, very good basis for letting go of anger later on. But you really have to understand it, right? You really have to internalize that. And that requires reflection. It requires thinking about it in the right way. But then when you learn to think about it in the right way, next time anger arises, you bring to mind that reflection that you have made for yourself. And because you have produced that reflection over a long period of time, it has a certain power to it, and that power dispels, annihilates, terminates that anger right there on the spot like that. And it's very powerful when it actually works. It's a very, very strong way of practicing. So that is what is meant by this. And now you can see that sometimes we have to be careful with reading the suttas, not to get the wrong approach. I do not mean by this that willpower is always wrong. Sometimes, you know, you're about to break the five precepts and your mind is cloudy, you don't know what's going on, and all you can remember, oh, I shouldn't really be doing this. Okay, so use willpower to sort of pull you out of the wrong situation, right? So sometimes it is right to use a bit of willpower. My point is rather that ideally we should use wisdom power whenever we can, because wisdom power is much more effective in dealing with defilements than willpower can ever be. Okay, so there you are. So those are the gross defilements of body, speech and mind. And then, I'm going to talk more about this terminate and obliterate passage later on, because there are passages which make it very clear that this concerns wisdom, and I want to point those passages out to you later on, so you don't think I'm just making this up and having some weird ideas that are not really in line with the word of the Buddha. And if you have any doubts about what I'm saying, if you think that maybe what I'm saying isn't quite right, or there is another angle which needs to be looked at, there's always other angles. I'm never going to tell you everything. I'm never going to be able to tell you, you know, what the Buddha taught. So it's always good if other people can fill out the picture or pick me up on areas where I go wrong or whatever. So please don't be afraid of bringing up points, write them down or whatever later on if you wish. Okay, so then we come to the middling defilements. These defilements are sensual thoughts, thoughts of ill will, and thoughts of harming. So these are a lesser form of defilement, and these things here are often very closely associated with the five hindrances, because when you abandon all thought of sensuality, of ill will, and harming here, harming is like being cold towards being, not having compassion, like being ruthless. This is the hinsa, right? Vihinsa or hinsa, the opposite of ahinsa. So this kind of sense of not caring about beings, just, you know, who cares what happens to them. The coldness of heart, not having a sense of compassion inside of you. So these are the kind of defilements that are very closely related to the five hindrances. And people often ask, I feel restless or I feel slothful and tired. How shall I overcome these particular hindrances? And the answer is that very often the restlessness and the sloth or tiredness, very often they are based on these hindrances here. They're based on craving, they're based on ill will or having a cold or hard mind. This is what they're based on. So very often, and this is why I think only three of the defilements are mentioned here, and you find many places in the suttas where just the three are mentioned rather than the five hindrances. Because once you remove these, the other ones tend to fade away as well. Maybe a little bit left in the mind, but very, very little. These are really the important ones. And you can see here that these thoughts of ill will, this is getting more difficult now, right? Now we're talking about abandoning all ill will, all desire in the mind. This is a very hard thing to do. Or maybe hard is the wrong word. It's not hard. It takes a lot of practice. It takes a lot of dedication. That's probably more correct. It's not hard like you might think physics or mathematics is hard. It's not hard in that way. But it needs dedication, right? That's why it says an earnest, capable bhikkhu. Somebody who is earnest about it. So again, what he does, he dispels, terminates, and obliterates these thoughts. And again, here, maybe even more than under the previous one, we're getting to more refined defilements. Again, willpower is not going to work on these very refined defilements. Here, because the mind is becoming more peaceful now, this is a path of meditation as well. The mind is becoming more pure. What is even more important now, again, is wisdom, to use wisdom to overcome these things. Why is ill will wrong? Why is desire wrong? How does it lead to suffering? Yeah. And the more you understand that, the more you reflect on that. This is part of vipassana. Vipassana just means seeing things clearly according to reality. Seeing where there really is dukkha, where there really is a problem. That sort of vipassana, very simple vipassana, but very important vipassana practice. That then leads you to overcoming these particular things. We're going to talk more about these defilements later on, but for now, I think that's all I will say for now. Okay, then, once you have abandoned these defilements, then there are still some very subtle defilements remaining in the mind. And these defilements are thoughts about his relations, thoughts about his country, thoughts about his reputation. Actually, I just noticed now that all of this is about his, and there are, I think, more women on this retreat than there are men, so I should say, just because it says his doesn't mean it doesn't relate to women as well. It relates to both genders, men and women. So just to make that clear, because sometimes the suttas, because they are spoken to the monks, they're always in the masculine gender. There are very few suttas that are spoken to the bhikkhunis. So because of that, it sounds like it just does, you know, it's only relevant for monks. It doesn't not relate to women, doesn't relate to lay people, but actually it relates to everybody. Yeah. Okay, so what are these defilements and thoughts about relations, about country and about reputation? And you will probably recognize that these thoughts here concern very much your sense of identity, right? Who am I? My relations, right? This is my family. I am the son of so and so. This is my brother and sister. These are my children, perhaps. And you place yourself, you exist very much in relation to the people who are close to you, your family members. This is about your sense of self. Your country, right? What nationality are you? You know, Norwegian, you know, German, Australian, Sri Lankan, whatever it is. Danish, are you still Danish, Venerable? Sort of, yeah. Sometimes you wonder, is the boundaries sometimes are a bit fluctuating, you know? So, yeah. So, but this point here, basically, it's about how we identify ourselves, who we think we are, about your reputation, right? You're concerned about your reputation, what do other people think of me? So this here is, because it is about identity, what this is saying, that the very kind of weak defilements at the end, when everything else is abandoned, have to deal with a sense of self, with who you are. So what this is saying is that to be able to enter deep samadhi, you have to let go a lot of the sense of self, the sense of, you know, I am such and such a person. Why is that? And the reason for that very often is because the sense of self tends to create all this verbal activity inside of ourselves, so often called papancha, all this proliferation happening inside ourselves. So, and the reason it does that, because if you are concerned about who you are, you will think about your past, right? You will think about your future. You will think about, oh, I hope these people that I see them in the right way. And all of these attachments holding on to who we are create thinking in the mind. Part of the reason why one does things like anapanasati, watching the breath, is precisely to overcome the thinking tendency of the mind, to reduce the sense of self, reduce the sense of your identity as a particular person. And it's quite nice not to have an identity, you know, to be narrowed down. You are Norwegian, okay, right? Maybe I am Norwegian, but so what if I'm Norwegian? Does it matter if I'm Norwegian or any other background? Or you are Sri Lankan? Does it really matter if you're Sri Lankan? Can come from any other country. These things are just real limitations anyway. We limit ourselves by these things. It's much more free to not be anything in particular, to just be a human being. I just am a human being. Even take away the gender, whether you're a man or a woman, what does it really matter? You're a human being. And then once you start to disidentify like that, the mind actually becomes more pure in a sense, because you think less about these things, and it starts to enable samadhi in a very different way. And when we go into a deep state of samadhi, they say that, like the Brahma Loka, the Brahma worlds, there is no gender there anymore. There is presumably no nationality either. There is no in all these kind of identity tags that we have, they sort of fall away in the Brahma Loka. You are just a Brahma. You just very happy, very blissful, everything is very good, right? So this is why these are refined defilements, because they tend to create papancha in the mind, proliferation, thinking in the mind. So again, you dispel and terminate these things, which again you try to use insight, understanding, vipassana, to actually abandon these things. Using wisdom is the way to go. And then if you are earnest and capable, you actually do abandon these things. And then it says here, when this has been done, there remain only thoughts connected with the Dhamma. Okay, here is one area where I actually disagree a little bit with Venerable Bodhi about the translation. I personally think the appropriate translation here is not thoughts connected with the Dhamma, but thoughts that accord with the Dhamma. Because for me, connected with the Dhamma, you can think about the Dhamma in many different ways. It doesn't mean your mind is very pure. But a thought that accords with the Dhamma is a thought that is in line with the Dhamma. It's a thought of metta, right? A thought of karuna, compassion. A thought of renunciation. This is the kind of thought that I think is meant here. And again, if you look at other suttas like the Dvaita Vitakka Sutta, Majjhima 19, two kinds of thought sutta, you will see there that the right kind of thought is precisely those thoughts. And this is the last thinking you do before you enter samadhi. This is what I think it means. And this thought that accord with the Dhamma could also, because what is meant here is vitakka, it could also mean the last little remainder, the movement of the mind when you get into deep samadhi. The first jhana, they say there's a little bit of movement in the first jhana left, and that is called vitakka, vichara, the movement of the mind, very slight wobble in the mind, and that may also be included here as vitakka that accords with the Dhamma. Anyway, the point is that even the good thinking has to be removed. That is what it is saying here. And this is another thing I will also come back to later on. And the reason why it must be removed is because we are trying to still the mind. Samadhi means stillness. This is what my teacher Ajahn Brahm, he says, forget about concentration. He says it's no good as a translation. And the reason it's not good is because usually concentration in English means force. It means willpower. You concentrate on something, and it means you apply force. That's how many people understand concentration anyway. Whereas stillness, and this is, I'm just quoting Ajahn Brahm now, just means peace, right? It means stillness, no movement. No movement is exactly what we are aiming at here. So because we're aiming at no movement, even the good thinking has to come to an end. And then then it says that that concentration, so perhaps the previous thing, the thoughts that accord with the Dhamma might mean the first jhana, or perhaps it means a slightly lesser form of samadhi, perhaps, because it is called that samadhi. Anyway, it is not peaceful and sublime, not gained by full tranquilization, not attained to unification, but is reined in and checked by forceful suppression of the defilements. So this is quite technical, and if you come to the suttas, this is the sort of thing that you might, you know, eyes might glaze over a bit when you see this kind of expressions, and you might wonder what's going on. But these words that you see here, these are all words that are connected with the jhana states, the very deep states of samadhi. Attained to full tranquilization. Full tranquility basically means the mind being completely still, right? And that complete stillness happens in the second jhana. Not attained to unification. Ekodi hoti is the Pali for that. Ekodi again, ekodi hoti, ekodi buddha, it says in the second jhana, means unification of mind, the mind coming completely together. So what this, all of this refers to, it looks like, is the second jhana is probably the most likely candidate, although it's difficult to be completely precise about these things. That is very likely what this is referring to. And you have peaceful and sublime words that are concerned with the deep states of samadhi practice. And then, just to make life really difficult, they have added this Lalita Vata or Onigaiha Varita Gata, depending on different readings. It's restrained, it's held under control. That's what it basically means. There's a certain restraint happening there. And this is what we do with the defilement. That you see the defilements coming up, then you use your wisdom to ban that defilement. That is a kind of restraint, using wisdom in that way. It doesn't mean using force or suppressing the defilements, anything like that. It's just a type of restraint connected with wisdom. Now, I said that in the Pali language, this is a word which has many different meanings, but one of the main meanings is that it's a synonym for the will. So the restraining is happening by way of doing, by way of activity inside the mind. This is what this is saying here. And this is very interesting. Gained by full tranquilization and attained to unification. It is not reined in and checked by forcefully suppressing the defilement. Then, there being a suitable basis, he is capable of realizing any state realizable by direct knowledge towards which he might incline his mind. So there comes a time, you keep on practicing, and eventually it happens. You're not waiting for it, you're not desiring it, you're not thinking, when will I attain this deep state? You're just waiting, and it happens by itself, precisely because you are patient. And then you do gain this wonderful samadhi, which is fully tranquilized, which is peaceful and sublime, right? Sublime is a very strong word in English, it's something very beautiful, right? It's sublime. You only say it's sublime about the very highest things in the world. They are sublime. Full tranquility, it means the mind is perfectly peaceful. Attained to unification, completely still, and then not. Willpower is completely gone. Not checked and reined in by forceful suppression. And then, being a suitable basis, he capable of realizing any state realizable by direct knowledge to which he might incline his mind. And this last one here means that he is able, and the sutta continues and it tells you all the things that are realizable. I took them out because a lot of that is about all this kind of supernormal powers, which I don't think is all that interesting, and we're going to come to the most important of the supernormal powers anyway later on, so I took it out for now. But most importantly, it's about realizing seeing the idea of rebirth, seeing karma, the workings of karma, and finally seeing the destruction of the asavas, the attaining of full awakening here. So that means and what is important point in this last phrase here is that once you have attained a jhana state, you are ready That is the foundation you need to basically attain full awakening. Yeah. And this is in direct agreement with how the Noble Eightfold Path works. You know, the Noble Eightfold Path, it starts off with Sammaditti, right? Sammasankappa, and it goes all the way down to Sammasamadhi. Sammasamadhi is the four jhanas. Now, the four jhanas is the last factor in the Noble Eightfold Path. And it's one of those very interesting things about the Noble Eightfold Path. It actually ends with the four jhanas. It doesn't end with insight. It doesn't end with awakening. It ends with the four jhanas. And it's a very interesting thing, and here you can see exactly why that is. It's because once you have gone to the four jhanas, then being a suitable basis, all you have to do is direct your mind, and these things happen on their own accord. So basically the path ends with the four jhanas, and these insights are a result of the practice of these four jhanas. This is what the Noble Eightfold Path says, and this is what you find right here. You might perhaps wonder what it means that there being a suitable basis. What does this mean? And what that means is that it means, I think, a number of things. It means, for example, that certain people have an inclination towards realizing supernormal powers. According to the Buddha Suttas, it's possible to, you know, read other people's minds, as opposed to possible to fly through the air and all these kind of things. That's what it says in the Suttas. So if it says, I always take it as on faith or on confidence that it probably is right. It doesn't mean that I know it myself, but it's just a confidence that I have in the word of the Buddha, at least until proven otherwise, as they say here. So some people have an inclination towards those things, and because they have that, they have a suitable basis for realizing supernormal powers. Another meaning here of the suitable basis may mean that people need different level of jhana to be able to attain the same kind of state. Depending on your personality, depending on who you are, you may require a more profound state of samadhi to be able to realize the same thing. Yeah? And that's why there are four jhanas in the Noble Eightfold Path. Not one or two. One or two may be enough, but four jhanas should always be enough. Yeah? Okay, so there you are, the gold, the soil remover, or the gold refiner sutta, about how to attain awakening. And the main point, I want to summarize again the main point of the sutta. The main point why I find the sutta so powerful is, first of all, the simile. I find it's a very beautiful simile there that explains how you do this. But the other important thing is basically that, remember, the reason why meditation doesn't work is because of defilements. It's not because of the method. It's not because you are using necessarily the wrong meditation object. It's defilements that are the problem. And that is where you're going to have to look if you want to improve your success in meditation in the future. And if you look there in the right way, and you are able to abandon those defilements, then meditation will gradually come together. Okay, so I think I will stop there, because I've been going for an hour already. So it's a very dense sutta, lots of information there. Fortunately, there isn't quite as much information in the other suttas. Okay, very good then.